Welcome to Book Waves. I'm Richard Walensky. My guest is Sue Monk Kidd, whose latest novel is The Invention of Wings. Earlier novel, The Mermaid Chair, also The Secret Life of Bees. There have been several nonfiction books on spirituality and feminism. This book, The Invention of Wings, deals with slavery in Charleston in the first part of the 19th century, focusing in on a pair of sisters, Sarah Grimke and Angelina Grimke, who actually existed, and they were feminist abolitionists at a time when feminism and abolitionism hadn't really gotten to a point where there would be change in the world. It also focuses on a fictional character, sort of fictional, named Hetty or Handful, who is the slave of Sarah. And there was an actual Hetty, but she died young. We'll get to all of that, but first I want to go back and talk about the origins of this book. You wanted to write a novel about sisters because you don't have any?
Yes. Well, I grew up with three brothers, and maybe this is part of what drives authors, is that we want to experience something we haven't lived. I don't know. I just had this notion, very vague, kind of sketchy idea, really, that I wanted to write about two sisters. I didn't know who they were, where they lived, when they lived. With that little seed, I showed up at the Brooklyn Museum, and this is where I discovered Sarah and Angelina Grimke in the Judy Chicago Dinner Party exhibit.
You've written about South Carolina before. You grew up in the South, and you had never heard of them.
Yes, very embarrassing, actually, that I hadn't heard of them. I think, in a way, that is partly a failure on my part to be aware of them. I mean, I really had this idea that I was fairly well-read on women's history. And yet, no, I didn't really know these sisters. Perhaps they teach them in elementary school in South Carolina, but I didn't grow up in South Carolina. That's going to be my excuse.
I think it's a part of history that the South doesn't want to focus on. I mean, they're willing to focus a little bit on slavery, but not on the anti-slave movement of that era. And, of course, for the rest of us, it was before emancipation, and these were Southern women. But also, a lot of history of women is forgotten.
Well, that's the whole point, in a way, of what Judy Chicago accomplished with this amazing The Dinner Party exhibit, is that women's contributions to history have been systematically kind of erased. And I think that's part of it, too. I mean, these sisters did fall in some kind of crack. They're known in academic realms, of course, and history students, women's studies students know about them. But in the popular culture, we don't seem to know their name like we would know Elizabeth Cady Stanton, for instance. And yet, they made pretty remarkable contributions to our American history, too.
The book Invention of Wings is more of an upstairs-downstairs story. Now, on the one hand, we have the Grimke sisters focusing in, as a point of view character, on Sarah in particular. And on the other hand, we've got Hetty, who you call Handful, who is a slave, approximately the same age, a little bit younger, I believe, than Sarah. And we follow her life as well, which means you had to write about an even more forgotten life, which is the life of the urban slave behind the walls of a compound.
That's right. It was really compelling for me to try to give a voice and a story to this character. When I found her, she was this little footnote, more or less, in Sarah's life. She actually did exist, yet she died very early on, probably in her adolescence. The only thing we really know about her from history is that she was given to Sarah. Sarah taught her to read. They were caught for this terrible act because it was against the law in South Carolina to teach an enslaved person to read. And they were punished. And that was it. So I thought, here's the other half of the story. And I wanted to imagine and give witness to her life. And that felt important to me because I think, again, like women's history sometimes, the lives of enslaved people have been lost and forgotten.
Do we know how they were punished?
In the record, it didn't seem nearly as dire as I made it in the novel. I've often said a novelist's job is to take a bad situation and make it worse. Well, that's what I did in that case. I think they were probably punished in a mild way. I stepped it up.
but you really don't know how they were punished. In fact, that seems to be one of the questions regarding the movie 12 Years a Slave. Was life for slaves as dire as in that movie? And, of course, the answer is, well, we don't know, for one. And number two, being a slave itself was pretty dire.
Well, exactly. I mean, how dire does something have to be called dire? I think the brutality of slavery was apparent to me when I was doing the research. It was shocking to me, actually, because I read the slave narratives of the 19th century. I read the slave narratives of the 1930s. And that's a whole other way of coming at slavery, to hear it through the eyes and ears and mouth of enslaved people themselves, to their narratives, their stories. It was pretty brutal from that standpoint. You know, we didn't live in that time, but I think if we take that testimony, it was certainly a vicious time.
Well, in an interview, you did say that because of all of those slave narratives, it was fairly easy to get a hold of Handful Hetty's voice.
Well, it certainly helped me to hear in my head the rhythm and the language of the slave narratives. It contributed a lot. In the end, of course, I just had to put that aside and let Handful speak as a character. And she had her own way of speaking, but it certainly helped, too, with memories from my childhood.
Memories from your childhood growing up in segregated South.
That's right. Those memories are still there. I grew up in the 1950s and 60s in a small town in Georgia, and I was surrounded by a lot of African-American women. I remember their voices. I'm sure that was part of it.
You did have more trouble creating the voice of Sarah, yet Sarah's voice must have echoed on some level Sue Monk Kidd's thoughts growing up.
I think you're right about that, yes. I mean, Sarah's voice was a little harder for me to get to, and I attribute it in part to the fact that she came with this big historical script, and I was trying to adhere so to it. And, you know, if you read her diary, her voice is kind of steeped in 19th century language and piety, and it was hard to get to. And I had to find her in my imagination and bring a modern sensibility into it. So I eventually found her voice, but I identified with her somewhat, too. I mean, her situation was more intense than mine, but I kind of felt like I knew what she was going through.
Sue Monk Kidd, you mentioned a diary. At what point in the research, was that at the beginning of the research, the diary? Was that with the Judy Chicago exhibit?
At the dinner party exhibit, I found their names on a heritage panel, and all it said was a female abolitionist and early women's rights pioneers or something to that effect. So I had to go explore their lives and really discover what amazing, daring women they really were, coming out of Charleston in the South and going on to become the first female abolition agents in America. Who would have ever imagined that kind of thing happening? And they became fighters for women's rights early on, before this was much in the culture. The diaries are housed at the University of Michigan, and Sarah doesn't have a lot of diaries, unfortunately. She has a record that she kept of just a span of her life. Angelina, her sister, was a little better about keeping diaries, but even then, it's not the whole of her life. But we have a lot of letters back and forth. They wrote enormous amounts of letters. And there are some excellent biographies, essays. So I found a good paper trail for them, actually.
Were you going to write the book even without the paper trail?
I was going to write this book no matter what, because as soon as I got back from that visit to the museum and I began to read about the Grimke sisters, I just knew that I wanted to write about them, that I would be willing to spend years, and I did spend years researching and writing about them. I'd been driving by their unmarked house in Charleston for 10 years, had no idea that's where they had lived.
How did you learn about the diaries and letters then?
I started with a wonderful biography by Gerda Lerner, the late historian, who has done more to bring forth their story and their life than anyone I know. And as I was reading her biography and then another book she has on Sarah's feminist thoughts, I could track pretty much, you know, what was available. And Sarah's diary is not published. It's so microfilm. Now, Angelina's is published, and all the letters are published, so they're out there.
It sounds as if as you began working on this Sue Monk Kid, suddenly it opened up because you realized that there was a lot of material on them, there was a lot of material on the era, and it was an era and a place that has not really been written about, which gave you kind of an in to something new.
Well, it felt new to me, particularly the whole notion of writing about urban slavery as opposed to plantation slavery. This is not the first thing maybe as Americans we think of when someone says slavery. It's very different. And so to be able to write about that, which wasn't quite as familiar, it operates so different. And also an era of early abolition. We usually are into more of the 1840s, 1850s, 1860s. But that antebellum time of the 1820s and 1830s, everything was really starting to come together and explode into what would become one of the great movements, certainly of the 19th century, two great movements, women's rights and abolition. And frankly, these sisters had a lot to do with that.
So Monk Kidd, somewhere along the line, as you were working on this, you discovered a man who's in your book, a real person named Denmark Vesey. We don't know what he actually did, but we assume that he was planning to lead a rebellion.
I think most historians think this is true. I mean, you can see it on the record. I went to the New York Historical Society and read a lot of the testimony of the trial that took place. There are some historians that might refute it. I'm of the opinion that not only did this happen, I mean, he was highly capable of this, but it was the largest slave plot in American history. And if it had actually taken place, I mean, if it hadn't been foiled, it was thwarted, his name would roll very easily off our lips, I think, in history. He put together, the extent of it we don't know, but he certainly put something together there.
And he was a free black man living in Charleston, meeting up with slaves on the side, developing this rebellion. And if it had caught on, it could have spread throughout the South, where Africans and African Americans, because they were still coming over, they had a majority.
Well, that's true. And in Charleston, the slave population was at some points even larger than the white population. That's what he hoped for. He hoped to set a spark that would take off and spread. It simply didn't work. But it was very daring. And the reason I wanted to bring Denmark Vesey into my novel, I mean, not only just from a storyteller's point of view, I mean, here's a male character who has this incredibly suspenseful, dramatic thing happening, and it's true. You know, so much of what I tried to record there is true. But I wanted to be able to acknowledge the resistance and the struggle of African Americans and free blacks and enslaved people at the time against the system. I mean, we don't touch on that as much. They were subverting the system in many, many ways we don't recognize.
It's one element of invention of wings. You know, we don't think about the fact, but the slaves would have been doing a lot of spitting into the soup.
Well, yes. And why not? I mean, I can't say that I wouldn't have done that myself. And that was one of the things that I loved about creating the character of Charlotte. This is Hanville's mother, who's a very fierce woman, who at every turn did what she could to resist and subvert the system. And even in the smallest ways, it mattered to her. It didn't have to be a huge slave insurrection being plotted behind closed doors like Denmark Vesey. For her, it could be just what you said. She took a shot however she could. And as Hanville says in one place in the novel, she says, you do your rebellions any way you can.
The white people in Charleston who were against slavery, they were kind of caught in a squeeze. If they did something wrong, their slaves could be sent to the workhouse against their permission. And the workhouse was a place where slaves were tortured.
That's right. It was horrifying, actually, to come upon this in my research. Somehow, I didn't know about that either. I think we put a little bit, no, maybe a lot of insularity around the subject of slavery in this country, where it's hard to look at it in its detail and brutality. And there it was, the workhouse, where you could actually send a slave to be punished 20 lashes for a half dollar. That's a highly disturbing thing to realize, that this was tolerated for a very long time in our country. I'm talking a couple hundred years.
There's a point fairly early on in the novel, and I mean, it's important plot-wise to make this happen, but I'm wondering if it really happened, where Sarah tries to give Hetty Handful back to her mother, and I'm thinking, why don't you just free her? Couldn't she have just said, Handful, let's go north and free her?
I don't know that she could have done that or not. I think the laws and the way the culture was arranged would have made that extraordinarily difficult, if not impossible, to do. Slaves leaving Charleston, leaving the South, the Deep South especially, they had to have passes, and Sarah had no way of leaving as a single woman except to go with her father. Her life was pretty much limited and controlled. She had very few rights. So I think that was something that probably was not likely.
If she had been able to take her slave Handful to the north, let's say to New York, what would be the slave's role? Would the slave still be a slave in New York, or could Handful just walk away?
You know, it's a legal question, and I'm not sure, but I suspect that Handful could just walk away if slavery had, at that time, had been outlawed in the state of New York, and it had, then she could probably. I have read narratives like that, where people in New York would go door to door to see if there were Southerners with their slaves visiting and would inform these slaves, you know, you're free here. I have read things like that, so probably that is the case, yeah.
It sounds to me, as you were working on this, you were changing. How can you not change and become, in a way, more radical?
I've always had a radical spirit. I don't know if people want me to even become any more radical, but you're right. I think when you spend 4 years with material like this and you feel the oppression and the injustice and what happened to these people, it might radicalize your thinking much more in a lot of ways, but I think what it does more than that for me, it just blew my heart open. You know, I think to read about this makes me more empathetic for people today. I mean, really, when you write a historical novel, you're really writing about the present. And what you want the book to do and the story to do is to, of course, enlighten our minds somehow, maybe make us a little more radical in how we approach things. We're not going to tolerate these kinds of things. You know, we're not going to render it invisible in that way. But you also want it to open people's hearts to the marginalized, to those who don't have a witness to their lives and don't have a voice.
In an interview, you said, racism is the great wound and sin of the South and the great wound and sin of America.
Yes, I think it's the original sin here. You know, we could even call it a 246-year Holocaust. I mean, it was a part of our history that no one wants to really look at, but I think we're beginning to look at. It's a sin that I don't think we've fully come to terms with, the depth of it. I don't think we've totally resolved all of that.
Well, I think if we look at the way people view in the South or, you know, view Obama, we can see that right there. The racism just shines right through.
I think there is racism that I have seen there, not even just in the South, but across the country. It seems to lurk in ways that are very disturbing.
Sue Monk Kidd, getting back to the book itself, you did a lot of research. How did you find out about clothing, about food, what they ate, what the slaves ate even, or how they went to the bathroom?
It was a mammoth job to go figure all that out, very daunting, and I did it by reading and reading and reading. I just explored libraries, historical houses, researched every place I could, and it comes together, you know, what books were on the shelf in 1803, the privy that was in the corner of the workyard, menus that I found at the Charleston Museum that would have a menu of a dinner party, and I'd write it all down. You know, it took months and months and really 4 years to write the book, and I was researching pretty much constantly throughout that.
As you were writing?
As I was writing, yes.
Along with the workhouse, which surprised you, what was the most surprising element that you discovered?
other than how raw and brutal urban slavery can really be and the kind of surveillance that was in place, almost like a police state, to keep that system intact, the shocking thing about slavery for me was how amazingly invisible human beings can render evil. We have this strange capacity to do that. You know, the relevant question is, well, how are we doing that today? You know, but the other part of it that was very surprising to me was just how limited women were, even white, privileged women like Sarah Grimke, who had no, I mean, not just, oh, I don't have the right to vote. That was only a small part of it. In many ways, she may not have had rights to her own children if she'd had any. She was property in her own way. And these were sort of twin forms of slavery that were going on at the time, even though the limitations of white women couldn't compare to the subjugation of the African American population.
Well, she couldn't be a lawyer. She couldn't go to college.
No, she couldn't do much of anything. She yearned for a real education. She was so intelligent, and her sister as well, and wanted to read and study and learn. She wanted a vocation. She wanted to be the first female lawyer in the United States. And, you know, she was crushed at every turn.
It brings out in the book, The Invention of Wings, Sue Monk Kidd, it brings out the fact that when she goes north, she's still under that same male oppressive foot.
Yes, well, it's got a large reach. She was amazed, actually, that when she was in the North, to come upon racism there, too. She thought perhaps everyone might be an abolitionist, but that was not the case.
And that's in her letters.
That's in her letter. I mean, she, you know, she was, I think, ahead of her a mini abolitionist. She was a little too radical for many of them. She believed in racial equality. Not all abolitionists believed in that. They were against slavery, but they drew the line. So there were gradations of all of that. You know, it was a learning experience for her to find out that her abolitionist male friends didn't necessarily support her right to go out and speak to mixed gender audiences. Like, you can talk to ladies in the parlor, but that's it. You know, so she fought a battle for that.
There's also, I was trying to get a sense of the different churches. I mean, she was radical for the Quakers, and the Quakers were pretty radical in those days. But there were the Methodists, the Baptists, and the Presbyterians. Presbyterians were abolitionists. Baptists, of course, were not.
The Presbyterians in Charleston were not, necessarily. I mean, Angelina, Sarah's sister, fought a battle there with the Presbyterian church. She wanted the minister to stand up and take a stand in Charleston, and he was against slavery. He was from New Jersey, but he couldn't do it. His livelihood was on the line. I think the point would be whether it's particular denominations, I mean, the Anglicans, the Methodists, the Presbyterians, the Baptists, I mean, many of these churches were supporting slavery. The institution of the church was supporting slavery in the South, just as the institution of education was.
Well, you've said that as hard as it is to believe, the evils of slavery were often invisible to those who saw it as essential to their way of life. I mean, you look the other way if you can.
Well, that went on a lot, and Sarah's father is an example of that. I don't know if the scene, the deathbed scene in my novel, reflects reality, but I always read him in my research as a very ambivalent figure about slavery. And I think this must have been true of a lot of people who had to know somewhere in their soul that this was wrong, but it supported their way of life. Their way of life would have fallen apart without the slaves.
Well, you wonder if this is going on in the brains of the 0.1% today.
One wonders. This could be something you could extrapolate a little bit of, but it's certainly worth the conversation, yes.
Sue Monk Kidd, there's a quilt in there that Charlotte, Handful Hetty's mother, is making, and this actually is based on a real quilt of Harriet Powers, is that correct?
That's right. She was an enslaved woman from Georgia. I think she was born in 1837, and she created these amazing quilts and told stories through the quilts. she would tell more or less Bible stories or local legends, and she would, I mean, they're just magnificent pieces of narration of a story. So that gave me the idea that an illiterate woman forbidden to read and write could actually tell her story through a quilt, like a visual memoir, and use it as an act of defiance, of a way of recording what is going on in her life and what is being done to her. And this is what Charlotte does.
There's one other element, which is that when you're talking the early 1800s, you're talking about people who are the children, grandchildren of immigrants. So there's still be a lot of African influence in how they were living their lives apart from Southern life.
Absolutely. I mean, it's amazing to see how much carried over across that transatlantic trip. The quilts, for instance, the symbols on the quilts, I mean, these came from West Africa, many of them, on Harriet Powers quilts, and they're hanging, you know, they're in museums today, archived, and when you can see how they actually came from Africa, the same kind of imagery and symbol in the textiles, some of the songs, some of the language. It survived, of course.
Sue Monk Kidd, you have an interesting history, a lot of which you've talked about in your memoirs, so I want to go into a little bit of it. You grew up in Sylvester, Georgia, in segregated 1950s. You witnessed a Klan march.
Yes, if we can call it a march. I'm not sure. I was a little girl, and I do have a memory of it, of the Klan, a handful really, coming down the sidewalk in full garb, terrorizing people. It was frightening to see, and I've never forgotten it. I mean, people scattered on the street. So that's a memory from my childhood, yes.
Both Secret Life of Bees and Invention of Wings deal a lot with white-black relationships. When you were growing up, what was your relation? Did you have any much contact with African Americans?
I did, in the sense that was culturally true of the time, in that we had African American housekeepers. And this was my primary way of being in touch with them, in the households of my grandmother, for instance, or later in my own home. And I had an African American caretaker. It was incredibly commonplace, no matter what your socioeconomic status in these little towns.
What about what you learned in history about the Civil War, the South, Confederacy, and slavery?
Well, I think we, you know, had the typical textbook to learn the history. The kind of romanticizing, you might say, of the old South that lingered.
Gone with the wind.
Yeah. And that can't go fast enough, but it lingers. It is something that seeps in maybe by osmosis somehow from the past and gets perpetuated. I'm not sure how that works, but it wasn't in the textbooks for sure.
Well, you became a nurse and lived a kind of quiet life until you read a novel by Kate Chopin called The Awakening, and that kind of changed you?
Well, it was a big turning point for me. I mean, of course, in any life, I think life is an evolution, and, you know, we have many turning points. And I had lots of awakening experiences going on around that time. I read Kate Chopin's novel. It had the same effect on me that maybe Betty Friedan's Feminine Mystique might have had on someone, because I read it through the lens of history. You know, here was a woman in Louisiana in the 19th century who was, I mean, a woman who had no rights. Culture was completely arranged against her, and I could identify, I could relate to that. And I saw things, and it affected me, and it woke me up. So I think, yeah, something started there.
What got you prompted to writing your first memoir?
I suppose I have this need to make sense out of my life somehow and create a story or a narrative out of it. It just seems innate with me to take the pieces of my life and try to put them in some sort of context or perspective and make meaning. And that was probably what drove me to want to do that, to set it into a story. I think doing that, this is actually what Charlotte was doing in The Invention of Wings. She's trying to take the pieces of her life, like quilt squares, and put them together into some kind of story. And I think story is very healing for us, our ability to make meaning out of our life and understand it.
Had you done much writing before then?
I didn't know anything about writing until I was 30, and I just started. I was trying to be a nurse. I, you know, went to college, got my BS degree in nursing. So what did I know about writing? But I just had this need, desire, very strong from the time I was a child to write. And eventually it won out. You know.
Did you send this memoir over the transom to an agent? What happened? I mean, going from writing a memoir and you going, I don't know what I'm doing.
Yeah, well, I didn't write it right away. I spent many years trying to find my voice, being a good apprentice, you know, to the craft. And I began to find, it's a process, you have to find your voice, you have to find your authenticity, your truth, your consciousness, and then begin to articulate it and have the courage to put it out there. It takes a while, I think, to do that. But, I mean, eventually, yes, I sent it out there, and somebody took pity on me and published it. Yes, that's how it started.
Well, you wrote a couple of the nonfiction works. What prompted you to finally say, okay, I'm going to tackle a novel?
I think I always wanted deep down originally to be a novelist, to write stories. When I was 12 and 13, I was ripping off Charlotte Bronte, trying to write little novels, you know, like Wuthering Heights or something. It was always in me to write story, whether it was the story of my life or some aspect of my life or a fictionalized story. But when I was around 40, this desire to write fiction came back with a vengeance. I had been, you know, trying to write my own narratives for a long time. And the world of the imagination just opened up a whole other realm for me. It was wonderful.
But you've also said that you feel that as a writer, you have a certain social responsibility on what you're going to write, too.
I suppose I do have that. I don't know how that works, why you write what you do. I think it's a confluence of so many things, from that organic seed that kind of wells up and it's your thing to write because it comes out of your worldview or your experience and background and kind of who you've become as a person. But at the same time, it's a mystery, too.
Sue Monk Kidd, you do something that a lot of writers don't do. You come up with the title of your book before you write the book. I mean, you had Invention of Wings, and then you were able to use that to develop the story of Handful and Sarah.
It's a strange idiosyncrasy that I have. I wouldn't recommend this to people necessarily, but I do need to have that title. It grounds me. It focuses me. It gives me something to sort of work toward. I mean, I have had a book that, you know, I didn't get it till the end. It changed. But mostly, I sort of know and I can write towards something. And this title particularly was helpful that way.
Because that's exactly what they're doing.
That's right. That's exactly what they're doing.
Did you hit any points? I know a number of writers will be writing something, and then they'll hit a dead spot, and they'll go, oh, God, what do I do? And then you have to backtrack a little bit and get around that. Did you hit any problems with this, other than finding Sarah's voice?
Well, there are a lot of challenges, of course. One of them is the fact that this book spans 35 years. I was terrified it might be 800 pages or something, and you know, it came out to be a normal-sized book, which was a relief. But it was a matter of trying to work with a large volume of material. That was a challenge. It was a challenge to make Handful and Sarah's stories have a kind of equal weight and substance. They couldn't overpower one another, and they had to be synchronized. So there were all kinds of interesting writerly kinds of challenges that went along with this. Another one was writing from the place where history and imagination come together and intersect, and trying to stay true to the history and at the same time let your imagination invent and conjure.
You had a way around that because Handful is primarily a fictional character. You were sort of more stuck, though, when you're telling the story of Sarah in the North because you are bound by her actual life.
And I wanted to be, because I want people to rediscover her, and I do revere her history, and I wanted people to read the book and come away with a sense of who she was and how she was formed to become and do what she did. Yes, it presents certain challenges because you've got this historical script. And at the same time, I grafted on a lot of imagined things in there, mostly in her relationship with Hetty Handful.
But the actual story of what it was like to live in the slave world and in the constricted world of a woman in the North, all of that is pretty much fact.
I believe so, yes. Yeah.
Sue Monk Kidd, Secret Life of Bees became a film. Did you have any work with the film, or did you just kind of walk away and go, whatever?
Well, somewhere in the middle of that, perhaps. I didn't walk away and go, whatever, but neither did they. I have any clout whatsoever either. I had the tiny role of, how would we say this, a kind of unofficial consultant. The writer-director for the Secret Life of Bees movie would call me and ask me all kinds of questions, and I got to read the script in its various drafts, and we would have these wonderful conversations late. She would call from California, and I was on the East Coast, and Sunday night about 11 p.m., the phone would ring or something, and I would have these great conversations with her as she was writing the script. So I feel like in that sense I was a sounding board. And if they ask my opinion, I was more than happy to give it to them. And sometimes they actually took my advice, but that's the extent of it, yeah.
Did you like the film?
I did like the film. I got an appreciation for how hard it is to do that, to take a book, particularly a literary book, and distill it down to 100 pages of dialogue. It's not easy to do and capture the heart and soul of that book. But I felt like in this case, they did a pretty good job of catching the spirit and heart and soul of the Secret Life of Bees. And I was pretty pleased with the movie.
Sue Monk Kidd, what about Mermaid Chair and Invention of Wings?
Well, the Mermaid Chair was a television movie on Lifetime, 2006 maybe or so, 2007. It was with Kim Basinger. It turned out pretty good, too. I thought it was fine. With The Invention of Wings, there is a movie option in the works right now, but it hasn't been announced, so I've been told to keep my mouth sealed about who it is.
It does sound to me that it could also be kind of a mini-series because it extends over so many years.
Yeah. Well, I think that's a possibility that's being considered, whether it's a movie, film, or a mini-series.
Long form.
It's up in the air.
Sue Monk Kidd, you talked a little bit before about what you got out of it, but when you walk away from any book, do you think they change you in any way, in any deeper way, on Invention of Wings? Did it do that much other than make you more firm in your feelings?
I miss hanging out with them every day. I do. I had very strong feelings for Handful and Sarah as I was writing. I loved them a lot, you know, and I think it's good for novelists to love all their characters somehow, even the ones that misbehave so badly. But what I loved about Sarah and Handful was their misbehaving, you know. That was the best thing about them. I think they had to change me. Their lives changed me. Their spirit changed me.
In line with that, were there points, I know that obviously you're the author and you're in control, but on some level, you're not. Did they surprise you? Did they do things suddenly? You're going, holy cow, I can't believe I just wrote that.
Oh, I've had that experience, I suppose. Sarah, not so much, because I kind of knew where her life was going. It was in history, and she did somewhat surprising things in the imagined part of her story. I think with Handful, she constantly surprised me with her audacity and getting involved with Denmark Vesey, you know. I didn't know quite when I was writing the extent of what she would do and, I mean, the level she would take it and how she would have to come to terms with all that. So that was kind of a surprise.
Do you think working on the memoirs and trying to put yourself out of it and just write without any kind of, say, barrier between you and the page, do you think that helps you write fiction then?
I do. That's very much the way I approach it, actually. I try to, when I start writing, you know, inventing on the page and working with the language, I really try not to think too much. You know, I have to stop sometimes and look things up and research things because I hit a wall and I don't know what's involved in that. But I do have to let all of that go and just write and trust that what is coming to me is what I need to say, and just let it flow out the best I can. And I think I write pretty instinctively, actually.
Sue Monk Kidd, you working on another book now?
No, I'm not. Not yet. I'm not ready to leave The Invention of Wings yet. You know, I feel like I just wrote the end on it the other day, and it's come out so fast since I finished writing it. Probably when the book tour is over and I have a little time to rest and let my mind and my creative mind be fallow for a while, I'm sure the next idea will come, but it has not come yet, and I'm not really actively looking for it either.
You've been listening to an interview with Sue Monk Kidd, whose latest novel is The Invention of Wings. I'm Richard Walensky on Bookwaves.